From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, in the waning days of the campaign, both candidates are fighting hard for Michigan and its 16 electoral votes.
Both these candidates are pretty fundamentally dishonest with a lot of average working folks and seem to suggest that they can go back to the 70s all over again. And the reality is that's not going to happen.
Bring It to the Table, a new film, tries to get us past political ranting and shouting.
I decided maybe I was part of the problem, and I am responsible for me, and so it was my duty as a citizen to learn how to listen.
Remembering the miners lost in an Upper Peninsula mine disaster 90 years ago this day.
Families gathered at the mine in the hope that their men would be rescued.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 90 years ago this day brought the worst mining accident in Michigan history.
Suddenly, there was a big rush of air, which to an underground miner is an indicator that something is amiss.
And indeed it was. Later in the program, remembering the Barnes Hecker mine disaster that rocked a community in the Upper Peninsula. But first, with the clock ticking down on the presidential campaign, Michigan, with its 16 electoral votes, is in the spotlight. The candidates and their surrogates are virtually tripping over each other, crisscrossing the state. Wednesday brought Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr., former President Bill Clinton, and Bernie Sanders. Today, Ivanka Trump is in Rochester, Governor Mike Pence campaigning in Portage. Tomorrow, more rallies. First, Pence in Lansing, and then Hillary Clinton in Detroit's Eastern Market as Eric Trump works his way through Michigan. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House believes all this activity proves the mitten is in play. Daniel, these are very precious final days. We even had Donald Trump here earlier in the week. Why so much attention from both sides?
Because Hillary's numbers are tanking. According to the Mitchell poll, she's lost 10 points in the last 12 days in Michigan. And I think the other thing that they're very concerned about is that they don't detect enthusiasm among the African-American community in Detroit that they've seen certainly in the last two cycles with President Obama. There's been a lot of anecdotal media coverage around the country talking to various black leaders who are essentially confirming that and saying that Hillary has not connected with the African-American community the way that the president did, and alleging essentially that they've taken them for granted. And I think the real concern here, and I think that's why you're seeing a lot of Trump campaign people here as well, is I think they're trying to essentially enthuse the Republican base to take advantage of the lack of enthusiasm in the Democratic base, particularly in places like Detroit.
When you stop and you know, as you point out in your column, the Republican presidential candidate hasn't won this state since George H.W. Bush did it in 88. Mm-hmm. You think it should be a no-brainer. And Donald Trump has not missed a chance to slam Ford Motor Company about jobs and trades and kind of without naming him, Governor Snyder, for the Flint water crisis. Mm-hmm. So, and as you point out, he's getting a lot of that wrong.
Yeah, and he's also trashed the Michigan manufacturing rebound and distorted it. You would think on paper that this would be a Democratic year in Michigan. I think what's interesting here is Michigan going to decide this thing? Don't know. But if, in fact, these numbers suggest that she is losing ground here, I think you then have to ask the question, is she going to be losing ground in similar states? Polling seems to show that Trump is up in Ohio. That would be considered a similar state, clearly. I think in Pennsylvania, she's holding on to a lead there, and I think most people think she's going to hold on to Pennsylvania. But, I mean, if you're Donald Trump and you can pick up Ohio and Michigan and maybe win Florida, I mean, that changes the calculus an awful lot for her. So I think that's why you see her heaviest of heavyweights, with the exception so far of President Obama, coming into the state. If you see him come in here over the weekend and come to Detroit, I think that would be a real sign that they're very concerned that they're losing traction.
Mm. It is interesting to think that the Reagan Democrats, particularly strong in Macomb County, are really at the forefront.
Well, I think there's a belief that they could be. And, you know, my sense is that some of the issues that resonate with that's a kind of a caricature, obviously, but that resonate with those kinds of folks are some of the things that Donald Trump has been hammering on for months. The economic nationalism, the anti-trade, those viewpoints have always been popular among rank and file. They've been popular because I think a lot of the problems of the auto industry, the Detroit-based auto industry, have been blamed in a lot of ways on trade, and I would argue that a lot of that's not accurate, that a lot of the troubles that the industry had and the car companies here in Detroit had were problems of their own making for many, many years. Mediocre products, huge debt loads, uncompetitive labor practices. But that's all now in a rearview mirror. So, but I think those arguments are still resonate, and that's why I think Trump feels he's at least got a shot.
And as you and I talked about on this show a week or two ago, that kind of argument that we're bringing jobs back isn't realistic in a sense. As you say, a Jimmy Carter era argument applied to the Google and autonomous car era.
Yeah, and I think that both these candidates are pretty fundamentally dishonest with a lot of average working folks and seem to suggest that they can go back to the 70s all over again. And the reality is that's not going to happen. We live in a global economy. We live in a very fast-changing, tech-driven economy as well. And I think the biggest fear is that the techification of so much of our society and of our economy threatens to leave a lot of people behind that don't have the right skills. And the people who have the skills and the flexibility are going to be the people who are going to be on the winning end, and those who don't are going to be more or less on the losing end.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
Well, this may have been one of the most unusual campaign seasons ever. There is one campaign promise that remains predictable. Candidates from across the spectrum routinely pledge that they will bring back the jobs. The next idea is Jeff DeGraff thinks that's not as easy as it sounds. He says that different kinds of jobs have gone to different places, and for different reasons, they aren't coming back.
So here we are at the end of one of the most odious and vitriolic campaigns in memory. Rather than adding yet more commentary, I'd like to dig deeper into the claim both parties make that they're going to bring jobs back to America. The question no one is asking is, where exactly will the jobs come from? Over the past 25 years, while many jobs have moved overseas, far more have been simply eliminated by the introduction of transformational software, systems, and technology. This has happened in three phases: transactional, translational, and transpersonal. Let's explore these one at a time. Remember when there were legions of telephone operators, bank clerks, and travel agents? While some jobs like that still remain, their number is a mere fraction of what they were a decade ago. That's because the internet and software have made it possible for the average person to connect, find what they're looking for, and manage the transaction with a minimum amount of help. These jobs went to low-cost technologies and will never return. Given that these were entry-level positions for many people, this first step to gainful employment is no longer a viable option. The next level of career busting is happening further up the earnings ladder. Time-honored professions like photography and architecture are being dismantled by information technology. Consider the fact that more photographs, albeit not necessarily good ones, are taken every day on smartphones than were made during the last 100 years. Recently, a colleague of mine designed a cottage using specialized software. Just in case he ran into trouble, there was an 800 number to call for assistance. With minimal revisions and input from the contractor, his cottage was built to spec. Finally, innovations have now made it to the top level of the earnings ladder, where years of training and experience are being replaced by transpersonal technologies. Attorneys are now the newest class of job seeker unable to find suitable employment. It's not just that degree mill institutions are turning out armies of lawyers, but also that turnkey and boilerplate law is now being performed by software or assembly line systems where lawyers handle hundreds of cases at a time. Look no further than LegalZoom, which is now the largest law firm in America. In our top medical centers, artificial intelligence is now being used to review MRIs and diagnose diseases. Intelligent machines can scan thousands of journal articles and clinical trials each day and suggest treatment therapies. While all this is being overseen by physicians today, one doesn't need to look too far into the future to see that the better these systems get, the less the doctor is needed. Perhaps the best example of the power of these transpersonal technologies is my own profession. In my 27 years as professor at the University of Michigan, I estimate that I've taught somewhere in the vicinity of 10,000 students. By putting a mere dozen of my lectures on a massive open online course, I've already taught more than 100 times that number in a single year. It has become clear to me that my job and career path are now on a new trajectory, and it's all I can do to keep up with it. Sure, there are some jobs that won't radically change. Fixing your car, giving an injection, mowing the lawn, or cleaning your drain. These are all skilled, valuable, and honorable careers, and we need them. But these are a mere fraction of the jobs required to drive growth in the new world of work. So to the candidates, I ask a very simple question. Where exactly will the jobs come from? The new world of work looks nothing like the old one, and neither will the solutions for job creation. Stop talking about the past. It's behind us now. Only the future lies ahead. That will require some innovative new approaches to job creation, and leaders capable of creating them.
Jeff DeGraff is an expert on innovation with the Ross School of Business and our partner on The Next Idea. The views expressed by Jeff DeGraff are not necessarily the views of this station or those of our license holder, the Regents of the University of Michigan.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities, michiganbusiness.org.
Up next, a new film aims to get us past the political ranting and shouting and start listening to each other.
And in highly partisan times, it's very hard for people to acknowledge that the other side might have a good idea.
Then what happens when someone is convicted and goes to prison for a crime they didn't commit? Wrongful convictions happen more often than you might think. How the state is tackling that issue. That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 5 days, we will vote. The deep distrust and dislike so many people feel for both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump has certainly fueled an exceptionally bitter campaign where political dialogue has all too often devolved into shouting profanities at each other. Julie Winokur is a filmmaker who hopes to provide an antidote to political ranting. Her project and documentary film, Bring It to the Table, is hoping to get us to stop bickering about politics. She's in Ann Arbor today to screen her film and get people talking. Julie Winokur, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You started this project because you got called out by your teenage son, didn't you?
I did indeed. When my son was 17, he told me I was the most politically intolerant person he had ever met.
What were you doing that prompted that? Because nothing like our kids to put us in our place, right?
Right. You know, they speak truth to power, that's for sure. They call you out on your stuff. We talk politics at the breakfast table every day. My husband and I are both journalists, you know, professionally, and we read multiple newspapers, we watch the news, we listen to public radio, and so we are constantly talking politics around the table. And my son ran out of patience, basically.
and so you saw yourself through his eyes. Mm-hmm. And with that led to the film and this project, Bring It to the Table. How do you want this to help people to start talking with and not at each other?
So the other part of what my son said to me was, if the other side had a good idea, you wouldn't know it because you weren't listening. And that was the real truth to me. And that's where the light bulb went off. I thought, you know, if I'm not listening, probably none of us are listening, or I can't speak for everybody, but I was frustrated by divisiveness. I was frustrated by what was going on in Congress, the paralysis.
What we see on social media everywhere.
Exactly. And social media brings out the worst of the worst in the way people speak to each other. They speak at each other in social media. So it really struck me that I needed to hold the mirror up and look at myself rather than pointing fingers at who were the problem. I decided maybe I was part of the problem, and I am responsible for me, and so it was my duty as a citizen to learn how to listen. So I decided I would travel around the United States with a small table and invite people to sit and talk politics.
The trailer that I saw for Bring It to the Table, it was striking so many a cross-section of Americans with views, and talk about the significance of the little potted yellow flower that's on the table, because this is genius.
So there's a small flower on my little cafe table. The table itself has a star-spangled tablecloth, and the flower is a yellow flower in a red pot. And the beginning of every conversation, I ask the person across from me to identify their political leanings by moving the flower right to left. And that was designed both as a visual element because I was shooting a film and I wanted something that would immediately give you a clue to who's at that table. It also forced people to look at their identity on a spectrum rather than right versus left. There are infinite stops along the way. And that flower has to be moved according to where you are on the thermometer, right to left. So it was a moment of really checking in and having people hesitate and have to say, well, I've never had to think of it in those terms, so let me have a moment and really decide, where do I stand? And I think that's the beginning of breaking down the nuance of our positions.
And then what kinds of questions do you ask them and what do they talk about?
Well, I like to begin by finding out what are the issues most important to you. When you identify politically, what comes to mind first? Then I always ask people what they think the other side gets right. And in highly partisan times, it's very hard for people to acknowledge that the other side might have a good idea.
That's a great question.
And it's tough. I mean, I will have people sit there who hem and they haw and they say, you know, I can't think of anything the other side has right. And when I hear that person I was when my son called me out.
Interesting. It reminds me of the town hall presidential debate and that final question when Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were asked by a voter, say something nice about each other. And that does it. It just kind of jolts you in the kind of discourse that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to wonder, then, what do you see when people have a chance to share their views? I know they're talking to the camera, i.e. you, and not to each other. But mm-hmm. What happens with that kind of process of being in a safe place to actually identify what's on your mind and speak it?
They have much more thoughtful, authentic conversations with me. And so they don't feel defensive. They don't feel under attack. I am not at the table with people to prove them wrong. I'm free to say, I've never seen it that way. I don't agree with that, but I'm really curious how you've come to that conclusion. And to me, the most important thing is that we self-examine where our beliefs come from, because we're never asked about that. So we kind of get on that train. We've always thought what we've thought, and we never stop and reflect and ask ourselves, am I being authentic in what I believe, and do I understand where that belief comes from?
And I'm going to go right back to what you said about social media, where you see people just, automatically sharing this and sharing that because it supports what they see as truth. Without examining anything, stuff gets passed that's completely bogus, but they saw it on the internet. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, will we ever be able to get ourselves set back into a point where we can talk in this kind of more examined, studied way?
I'm hoping we can, and that's the point of bring it to the table. My goal with this is really one citizen at a time. And it's me being that pebble in the pool. I am not going to change Washington, D.C., but I'm in the midst of a tour around the United States. I've been focusing mainly on college campuses, which is why I'm here in Ann Arbor. And my feeling is that I'm hoping to inspire ambassadors for civility. And that's really the best we can hope to do. We're not going to influence the politicians, but we need to lead them and set the model.
Well, there's a lot of thought that on November 9th, after we have chosen one of those candidates, we were going to have a lot of work to do. I think there's a lot of people worried things are going to be even worse after Election Day.
Absolutely. And the irony for me, I started this 4 years ago. It was bad 4 years ago. I thought, it's terrible. We've got to fix this. And look what, it got worse.
It got worse.
And I'm hoping we haven't, that this is bottom. I'm hoping this is bottom. We're not going to go deeper down. Mm-hmm. But it's incumbent on us to reclaim what it means to be American, what it means to have your eyes on that prize. We want to make this the safest, richest, most comfortable, supportive, embracing big umbrella that we can. And it's on each of us to stake that claim, not to identify as partisan before American.
Yes, get on the same team.
Indeed.
Get on the same team. Julie Winokur will be screening her film Bring It to the Table and holding a discussion this evening at the University of Michigan. It's organized by the Ginsberg Center. The event is at the Annenberg Auditorium, and it runs from 6:30 to 8:30. You can also learn more about this project and Julie's work by going to the website bringittothetable.org. And let me note, that is the number two, bringittothetable.org. Very fascinating work. Hopefully the seeds that you're planting will be blossoming in the years to come. Julie Winokur, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. From a youthful act that landed him in prison to his release and growth into a man whose life work is mentoring youth in Flint, the life of Hubert Roberts is a powerful lesson in redemption. Now his story is being told through the work of a Michigan State University professor and her team. The project is called Hubert, His Story, a documentary film and a comic book featuring the life and work of Hubert Roberts. And he's with us now. Hubert, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, hello. Hi, everybody.
Good to have you with us. And we want to welcome Jerry Alumet Zeldis. She's an associate professor, and she directs the Journalism Graduate Studies at Michigan State University. And welcome. Good to have you here, Jerry.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell me, how did you find Hubert, and why did you feel it was very important to tell his story?
I'm from Flint, and I'm very connected to Flint through my documentary film projects. And so the Michigan Humanities Council has had this new grant opportunity called the Heritage Projects. It's also funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. And so I looked to Bob Brown, who is in the office of MSU's Extension in Flint, and I was like, can you please help me find somebody who mentors students, who uses the humanities to educate students in Flint? And he's like, oh my gosh, you need to meet Mr. Hubert Roberts. He has an interesting story. He's been incarcerated, but he's used his time post his release to impact students.
And Hubert, I know you head up a number of programs in Flint that are really focused at mentoring young people. And I also know this, that when you look someone in the eye and say, listen, you do not want to land in prison, you know what you're talking about. Could you tell us what happened when you were young?
Oh, yes, ma'am. When I was younger, I was born in Chicago, and my dad got a job at V8, and we soon followed him over. My dad was murdered when I was 12 years old by a sister. She was trying to commit suicide and shot my dad. So that put our family in pretty dire straits, losing our dad like we did. So I was very angry for a number of reasons. One, my dad used to beat my mom, myself, and one of my sisters, and I didn't know how really impactful those things were in my life as far as the trauma that I received, as I start growing older. And being a little bit more mature to some degree, working for a family business. So my job was I was a service manager for a vending company. And on the weekend, I would collect money out of the different machines, cigarette machines, pinball machines, pool tables, jukebox, things like that. Anyway, so one night, some people were throwing a surprise birthday party for me, and so instead of putting the money in the night deposit box, I left the money in my home, and a guy I had taken in, he was homeless. I took this guy in, and anyway, he stole my money and went to another state, and unbeknownst to me and our community, you know, when something happens to you, the code of the street, you know, you got punked out, you know what I mean? This guy, you know, got off on you. So I was living with that kind of mentality at the time, and I wanted to retaliate. So I took the law into my own hands and told some people that was working for me, you know, to kill him, literally. And it's just thankful to show you how God works as far as they didn't kill him. And they found me guilty of conspiracy to kidnapping.
And what was your sentence?
My sentence was 17 and a half to 25 years for conspiracy to kidnapping and aggravated assault.
But you're out. What was it that helped you make that transition from somebody who had been incarcerated to somebody who is now a mentor to young people to keep them from following that path?
Well, there's a lot of things. Before I went in, my mom was a community activist, teacher, And we did a lot of things that we had to do with her that I didn't know that it was becoming a part of me. When I was incarcerated, I found out that a lot of the young people that were coming into the prison system was being mistreated, being raped, and a lot of things were going on. So I got with some other guys and was trying to protect some of these young men from being molested. So it was a combination of people that I met in there. I met some tremendous older people that had been doing 20 and 30 years that they really became like surrogate dads to many of us as far as teaching and guiding us even in that inhumane environment. I always had a sense of community and a sense of self-worth to some degree. So like I said, I went in when I was 29 years old and I had particular values about myself, about my life and my family. So I was clear about that. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, incarceration or prison, I wouldn't wish it on anyone because you can go either way. And what really kept me as far as being focused was a relationship with my family, a relationship with God, and also being around positive men in a negative environment. And there were some positive prison guards, too. I must say that, too.
But now you want your work is important in keeping young people from making the kind of young person mistake that you did. And Jerry and her team are telling your story. Jerry, tell us about how you're constructing Hubert's story.
So we followed Mr. Roberts for about a year or so. And we have been invited to also meet with some of his students at Northwestern High School. And we show through the days that we followed Mr. Roberts how much he means to these young men and women.
In what ways? What did you see?
He really has become a father figure for not just one student, but many of the young men. And he has, you know, in part, become so close to these young men, maybe to, and Mr. Roberts mentions this in the film, to fill the void in his life because he hasn't had an opportunity to have a close relationship, at least with one of his sons. And he is trying to redeem himself through these relationships at Northwestern High School.
Certainly, certainly. And along with the film, Hubert, his story, there's also the comic book Growing Up in Flint. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we have a new faculty member in Comm Arts. She's in the School of Journalism, my unit, and her name is Stacy Fox. She has created this narrative in which she has brought in Mr. Roberts as a teacher. Mr. Xavier. So Mr. Xavier assigns a student in the comic book this exercise to tell us about your history.
And that's at the root of your work as well, is it not, Hubert?
Oh, man, it's critical. It's the foundation, because if you don't know what happened behind you, how are you going to have a clue of what's happening around you or in front of you? So that's really, really important. And most of our children and Americans have such a distorted view or understanding about our own history in America, let alone the world. You know what I mean? And we're trying to get them away from thinking of themselves as criminalized or in the media being black people being so criminalized. And we're trying to get these children to think outside of the box, and they have to have an understanding about where they came from for that to be a possibility.
Hubert, what do you hope people will take away from watching the film and reading the comic book?
What I'm hoping that people will take away is that whatever your asset is, wherever you are, you can do something. So often people say, well, they complain. What I'm saying is let's be advocates of strategic doing, meaning what is in your power to do. If it's tutoring, if it's volunteering, if it's coming and greeting the students, if it's just something simple as cutting someone's grass or saying hello, how are you this morning? We're trying to get people to start thinking about not so much of complaining, but what you have the power to do yourself without asking anybody else. And to greet someone and say, I love you, I'm proud of you, that doesn't take anything but your effort to do that.
And that certainly builds community, doesn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
The film is Hubert, His Story, and the comic book is Growing Up in Flint. And you can learn more about both by going to hubertdocumentary.com. And we've been speaking with Hubert Roberts, the subject of both, and Jerry Alumet Zeldas, professor from Michigan State University. Thanks to both of you, and best of luck with the project, with the film, and with the comic book.
Thank you.
Still to come, remembering the man lost in Upper Peninsula mine disaster 90 years ago.
The day was one of disbelief and shock and horror.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 1967, many American cities were rocked by civil disturbances, certainly including Detroit. Black people rose up against police brutality and unfair treatment. A presidential commission looked into what should be done. That Kerner Commission found that among the concerns, black people complained the courts administered justice in a discriminatory way. Here's a quote, in a way that presumption of guilt attaches whenever a policeman testifies against a Negro. Today, there are more people of color on police forces, in prosecutor's office, and as judges. But African Americans are still being convicted of crimes they did not commit at a higher rate than white people. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham and Detroit Public Radio's Sandra Svoboda, working with the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, report this is an issue that Michigan is slowly beginning to correct.
Black people are sentenced to prison at a much higher rate than white people, and people of color are also wrongfully convicted at an even higher rate because the justice system failed them. That was the case for Deshaun Reed from Wayne County. He and his uncle, Marvin Reed, were convicted for shooting a man in the back of the head. The victim identified the Reeds as the men who shot him. Despite little evidence other than the victim's testimony, the Reeds were sentenced to decades in prison. Later, much later, the victim said he was wrong. Deshaun Reed spent 8 years in prison for something he didn't do. He says prison was hard, but the worst moments were those when he was prepped to be transferred from one prison to another.
Y'all don't got on nothing. Everybody in there is butt naked. You know, you got to bend over in front of them. You got to spread them. You got to lift them. You know, that was just so humiliating. Then, you know, you got to get shackled all the way down. And that was the roughest for me.
The Michigan Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School picked up his case. They discovered that the gun used in the shooting was found on a man who was killed while trying to steal a car, a man who was seen near the shooting that was blamed on the Reeds. So how does the justice system get this wrong? Brett DeGroff is an assistant defender with the State Appellate Defender Office, representing indigent defendants.
There are innocent people in prison because the criminal justice system is not an infallible machine. It's just a group of people trying to do their best, and people make mistakes. And when people make mistakes in our criminal justice system, that means that innocent people go to jail.
About 1,900 people have been exonerated in the past couple of decades. DeGroff says many of them have a few things in common.
The people going to prison that are actually innocent are disproportionately poor and minority communities that are overpoliced in ways that suburban and wealthier communities are not. And the people that are getting convicted are just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, maybe. And the scary thing is, once you drill deeper, it could be anybody from those communities.
The innocence clinics across the nation say there are several reasons for wrongful convictions. Eyewitness misidentification is the biggest problem. Studies consistently show people are much better at facial recognition of strangers of their own race than people of a different race. Government misconduct is another reason. It might be as simple as investigators ignoring a piece of evidence that, in the hands of a defense lawyer, might prove innocence. There is suspicion of that happening more often in cities where the police force is majority white, but the population is more black. Another major problem is bad defense lawyering. While every county in Michigan has a prosecutor's office, few have public defenders. Private attorneys are often paid a flat fee and given little incentive to investigate or call witnesses. Many don't meet their clients until the day of the trial. Often they encourage their clients to plead guilty to lesser charges, and even the innocent feel trapped in these meet-and-plead sessions. Michigan is tackling that last issue of bad lawyering. Tom Boyd is a judge in the 55th District in Ingham County. He's a member of the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission. It's working to make sure every indigent defendant has a fair day in court. Proposed standards include better training for defense lawyers, time and private space for attorneys to meet with their clients, requiring attorneys to investigate the case, and making sure a defendant has a lawyer at an arraignment and pretrial proceedings.
The justice system works best when you have three people really on their game, and that's the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense lawyer. If one of these three people really didn't come to play, we're not sure that justice is the final result.
A proper defense is not the only problem. David Moran with the Michigan Innocence Clinic says many police departments, prosecutors' offices, and the courts have heavy caseloads that make shortcuts tempting. That's especially true in urban areas with large minority populations.
Frankly, nobody has all the resources. The prosecutor's office doesn't have the resources, and the police department doesn't have the resources to do an adequate investigation. So it's not just the defense. It's these counties that are underfunded, typically places like Flint, Detroit, Benton Harbor, where there's large minority populations. So there's a systemic problem that leads to wrongful convictions.
If you are wrongfully convicted and lucky enough for one of the innocence clinics to pick up your case, it will still take years to resolve. If you get out of prison, there's nothing beyond freedom. Those years are lost. Often the wrongfully convicted have no money. It's hard to get a job because their record of conviction is not expunged for as long as 3 years after release. Even if they were to get help to re-enter society, as parolees do, and reimbursed for the years they were locked up, as has been proposed, the innocent who do time in prison lose a lot. Tyneel Reed sat with his brother Deshaun as we interviewed him. He worked to find proof that his brother and his uncle did not do the crime for which they went to prison. He says Deshaun has changed.
Before he was more sillier, he was more like a jokester.
Yeah,
and
that got taken away.
That got taken away. Like
I wish I had that. I wish I still had that. You know, silly is like everything. I'm just so uptight now. Like, you know what I'm saying? I was more happier, funny, laughing, and just I'm just more uptight now. You know what I'm saying?
Most of us don't know. It's hard to imagine going to prison when you know you're innocent, but it still happens. And it's still more likely if you're poor and a person of color. With the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
This piece was reported by Lester Graham of Michigan Radio and Sandra Svoboda of Detroit Public Radio. Tomorrow on Stateside,
we're moving in the right direction, but we're nowhere near there yet. Michigan has one of the nation's worst systems for providing lawyers for poor defendants.
Stateside's Lester Graham will continue the conversation on wrongful conviction with David Moran, co-founder of the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Many such clinics base their work on DNA evidence, which has led to clearing the names and the release of hundreds of people. The Michigan Innocence Clinic operates a little differently. It pursues cases where DNA evidence is not available. Tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 90 years ago this day brought the worst mining accident in Michigan's history. The Barnes-Hecker mine disaster on November 3, 1926, killed 51 miners. The disaster rocked the community west of Ishpeming. Mary Tippett's grandfather was killed in the disaster. It was his first day on the job. This anniversary week, Mary Tippett is working to make sure that the legacy of the miners and their families isn't forgotten. She's one of the organizers of the 90th anniversary Barnes-Hecker Remembrance, and she is with us now. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you so much for inviting me to participate in the program, Cynthia. I really appreciate it.
Mary, tell us exactly what happened on this day 90 years ago.
The morning began routinely with the day shift starting at 7:30. And the routine typically involved drilling and setting dynamite charges that would be detonated around 11:20 or 11:30 in the morning immediately prior to the lunch hour. What happened on November 3rd, 90 years ago, was that at 11:20, blasting was heard underground, and suddenly there was a big rush of air, which to an underground miner is an indicator that something is amiss. There was rumbling and another rush of air, and the power went out. The men who were on the second level recognized that something was terribly wrong, and they ran to the shaft. Actually, they groped their way to the shaft in the dark and headed for a ladder to the surface. They also hailed a co-worker on the first level. So altogether, there were four men climbing a ladder for their lives, knowing that the mine was flooding. The water was coming up to the feet of the one man who escaped. And that one man was Rutherford Wills, my half-great-uncle, brother to Walter Tippett.
Your grandfather. And it was his first day on the job?
Yes, my grandfather had been the night captain of the Marquette Police Force and had worked at the prison in Marquette and had had a couple of close calls, and specifically in which gunfire was exchanged and Walter was the officer who had shot and killed a criminal. And he had a difficult time with that and was concerned for his own safety and for the future of his family. So he convinced his brother William, the mine captain, to give him a job at the Barnes-Hecker mine where he would be safer.
And I know that this Barnes-Hecker disaster, the third worst non-coal mining disaster in the entire country. How was the community affected that day in 1926?
The day was one of disbelief and shock and horror. The mine whistle started to shriek when it was known that there was something radically wrong. Ripples of shock went through the community. Families gathered at the mine in the hope that their men would be rescued. Reporters started to converge on the area. Curiosity seekers did. And the mine site was then ultimately closed except only to family members. There was an outpouring of support for the families. One wonderful example was from the time that the Mining Journal's Extra hit the street at around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the telephone switchboard lit up and went crazy. And the switchboard operators, the telephone company called in Extra switchboard operators, and those were the days when they individually plugged in the connections. And the operators said, "I'm sorry, the line is busy. Let me call you back when that line is free." And those operators worked for 2.5 hours straight through their dinner hour to make sure that every single family connection was made. There was an outpouring of support for providing cars for the funerals, providing food and whatever the families might need. And the sympathy and the attendance at the funerals was community-wide. And at that time, the population of Marquette County was 45,000 people, and Ishpeming was the largest city. So at one funeral, the attendance overflowed into the street, and it was estimated to be about 700 to 1,000 people who tried to attend that service.
You get goosebumps as you describe that. I absolutely can feel what that was like. And this network of people and family and community members still honoring the men today is very strong. You've been busy all week with remembrances. Tell us some of what you're doing.
We have had an amazing response to the events that we've held so far. They began in mid-October with a lecture by my co-chair, Jim Paquette, who is a local historian, president of the Marquette Regional History Center Board, and an experienced safety expert in mining. The outpouring at his talk was unbelievable. People were in tears listening to it. They were approaching the planning group and thanking us for what we were doing. The events will continue actually this evening with the Ecumenical Memorial Service. And as far as we're aware, it'll be the first time since maybe 1927 when there's been a community-wide church service dedicated exclusively to remembering these men.
And I'm very interested in, and I think it's a powerful statement of what you're going to be doing this Saturday night at the Cliffs Shaft Mine Museum. Tell us about that closing event.
We are very excited about being able to give the descendants and families something that they have never had before. And specifically that is that we have all of the names of the women, all of the names of the wives of the miners. And when the men's names are read, as they will be this evening at the worship service, the men's names will be read along with their wives' names. And it'll be the very first time ever that the names of the husbands and wives have been given, read, presented aloud anywhere at any time in history.
And I know you're holding it in the unheated dry room?
That's correct. We've expanded the space a little bit more. There's an adjacent room called the Rock Room that the local rock club uses from the museum. That room is heated. It has chairs. It has a microphone. And there'll be refreshments. So people will be able to spend time in the unheated dry to remind all of us that those families stood in the cold on November 3rd in 1926, waiting for word, with snow on the ground and wind in the air. And this way we can recreate some of that feeling while still providing a comfortable environment for families to gather, enjoy some refreshments, be able to visit with one another, and connect.
Mary, how has what happened to your grandfather, his story, how has that impacted your life?
It has given my life a very strong awareness of the necessity of sharing one's family history. My family was very lucky because we lived on the same block with my grandmother. And the Barnes-Hecker story was one that we have known about since we were small children. At the same time, there was an awareness of my father, who really did not talk much about how different his life might have been if he had had his father. What he and my grandmother did was be thankful for what they had and built a legacy that is focused on solving problems, moving forward, preparing your kids for unexpected consequences, learning how to sew on a button, learning how to hammer and nail and saw. And it was something that we felt was part of our DNA, I guess, is the best way to describe it. The remembrances that we did, including going to the caved-in area where a lake had formed, we would go there in the summertime when we were children and lay flowers on the water. And we don't forget the symbolism and the importance of all of that. And it wasn't until I had reached my retirement years that I really had time to thoroughly read everything that was involved and start to see the human impact of what this meant. And I'm so grateful for what my grandmother did, how she conducted her life, which was with gratitude and with joy. And yes, with a few curse words here and there, she was a very lovely, wonderful, warm, normal woman. They taught us survivorship and gratitude. And that's really a gift that is beyond any price tag you can apply.
Mary Tippett is the co-chair of the Barnes-Hecker Remembrance Committee, marking today the 90th anniversary of the Barnes-Hecker mine disaster that claimed 51 miners' lives, including her grandfather. Mary, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation very much.
And we always want to hear from you and find out what stories are you focusing on or issues that you want to hear more about. Just let us know. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org, and just click on the link that says Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.